I've already been questioned about the title to our Memorial Day special today. I don't know why. But when you have a boring Bible class, you must rivet your attention at the very beginning. There's a reason for this title, as we will discover over the next 2 hours. We're going to study today the Saratoga campaign and American independence. And as we go through this, I would like for you to keep one principle in mind, that Jesus Christ controls history on behalf of the pivot. We need to start with British strategy that was the introduction to this particular campaign. Sir Edward Shepherd Creasy, a British historian who lived from 1812 to 1878, was an English historian that was educated at Eton and King's College, Cambridge. In 1840, he was appointed professor of modern and ancient history at the University of London. Creasy's most popular work is his 15 Decisive Battles of the World. It was first published in 1851, and I'm fortunate to have an original copy. In his chapter 13, The Victory of the Americans over Burgoyne at Saratoga, A.D. 1777, Creasy outlines the British strategy to defeat the colonials. The five northern colonies of Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and Vermont, usually classed together as the New England colonies, were the strongholds of the insurrection against the mother country. The feeling of resistance was less vehement and general in the central settlement of New York, and still less so in Pennsylvania, Maryland, and the other colonies to the south, although everywhere it was formidably strong. But it was among the descendants of the stern Puritans that the spirit of Oliver Cromwell breathed in all its vigor. It was from the New Englanders that the first armed opposition to the British crown had been offered, and it was by them that the most stubborn determination to fight to the last rather than waive a single right or privilege had been displayed. 1775, they had succeeded in forcing the British troops to evacuate Boston. In the events of 1776, had made New York, which the Royalists captured that year, their principal basis of operations for the armies of the mother country. A glance at the map will show that the Hudson River, which falls into the Atlantic at New York, runs down from north at the back of the New England states, forming an angle of about 45 degrees with the line of the coast of the Atlantic, along which the New England states are situate. Northward of the Hudson, we see a small chain of lakes commencing with the Canadian border. It is necessary to attend closely to these geographical points in order to understand the plan of the operations which the English attempted in 1777, and which the Battle of Saratoga defeated. Now, this is the best map I could find of the entire Hudson River on all of the Internet. Lake Champlain is here, and it runs southward, obviously. It forms the border between New York and Vermont. And there's a chain of lakes as you move southward. In Essex County, along about in here, you have the mouth of the Hudson River. The mouth's down here, the origin of the Hudson River, the headwaters. And then you have other lakes such as Lake George. And eventually, as you move down, as Burgoyne did with his troops, you eventually make it to the Hudson River as it curls over eastward at this point, and you have Lake George right here. Now, as they move south, you move into the area of Saratoga here. South of that is Albany. And then ultimately, as you move down southward toward the Atlantic, you have the Hudson River spilling into the Atlantic Ocean at this point here. Now, over here is New England, and these are the dyed-in-the-wool patriots, the ones who kicked off the rebellion. And then down here you have New York City, which has recently been conquered by the British. Over to the left, you have New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and then to the south, the Atlantic Coast colonies. the strategy that we will notice we go forward that the British had cooked up was to bring forces from the north out of Canada, which is up here, and to come down this chain of lakes down to the Hudson and capture the Hudson waterway. And to do that, the major settlement was at Albany, and therefore Burgoyne is going to come down and try and take Albany, while others, various ones, Howe being one, there are others who supposedly were going to meet him at Albany and take down that city. There are complications that arose from these operations from the south, and we'll get to those today. But the issue, the target, the objective of Burgoyne is Albany. And he had to fight his way through a number of fortresses that the colonials had established along the way. And there's going to be a conflict that occurs at Saratoga and its environs. So that's where we are geographically as we move forward in our study. Now, continuing with Creasy, the English had a considerable force in Canada. And in 1776 had completely repulsed an attack which the Americans had made upon that province. The British ministry resolved to avail themselves in the next year of the advantage which the occupation of Canada gave them, not merely for the purpose of defense, but for the purpose of striking a vigorous and crushing blow against the revolted colonies. With this in view, the army in Canada was largely reinforced. 7,000 veteran troops were sent out from England, with a corps of artillery abundantly supplied, and led by select and experienced officers. Large quantities of military stores were also furnished for the equipment of the Canadian volunteers who were expected to join this expedition. It was intended that the force thus collected should march southward by the line of lakes and thence along the banks of the Hudson River. The British Army from New York, or a large detachment of it, was to make a simultaneous movement northward up the line of the Hudson River, and the two expeditions were to unite at Albany, a town on the river. And by these operations, all communication between the northern colonies and those of the center and south would be cut off. An irresistible force would be concentrated so as to crush all further operation in New England. And when this was done, it was believed that the other colonies would speedily submit. The Americans had no troops in the field that seemed able to battle these movements. Their principal army under Washington was occupied in watching over Pennsylvania and to the south. At any rate, it was believed that in order to oppose the plan intended for the new campaign, the insurgents must risk a pitched battle in which the superiority of the Royalists in numbers, in discipline, and in equipment seemed to promise to the latter a crowning victory. Without question, the plan was ably formed, and had the success of the execution being equal to the integrity of the design, the reconquest or submission of the 13 United States must in all human probability have followed. And the independence which they proclaimed in 1776 would have been extinguished before it existed a second year. No European power as yet came forward to aid America, a significant point. At this point in 1776, in the summer, the colonies were on their own, and they had declared independence a full year before. So they were fighting on their own, and they were doing it largely with militia. Militia has to do with state national guard, we call it today. And they would be assembled, and therefore a lot of volunteers would join their individual state militias and join up with the Continental Army or function independently. Now let's go to the Saratoga campaign. Let's note the prelude to the battles. There are two major battles. Actually, there are three, but we will ignore the middle one. The commander of the British Army in Canada was Major General John Burgoyne, a veteran of the 7 Years' War that raged from 1756 to 63. The theater of war was the European continent. But for England, it was simply a continuation of the French and Indian War in America that had resulted in Britain controlling colonization of the North American continent. Therefore, the French are a little bit ticked, and they will come into the picture later on. Will you note the picture here of Burgoyne? He considered himself to be a sophisticate. He was not, but he married into a little bit of royal blood, and as a result of that, he got promoted and made it to Major General in the British Army. He captured Fort Ticonderoga, but was defeated in the Saratoga campaign by Major General Horatio Gates of the Continental Army in 1777. Interesting to note that the battle at Ticonderoga sent messages to both England and France that the colonies could not stand. So this was a major battle that occurred just a few months before the Saratoga campaign. And in England, they had their blood up, believing that they now had the advantage over the colonists. And, of course, France at that time was dickering as to whether they would support the colonies or remain neutral. Now, Burgoyne was charged with executing the plan to separate New England from the southern colonies by controlling the dividing line marked by the Hudson River. The strategy to secure colonial positions at Crown Point and Ticonderoga and the area around Lake Champlain in the northern Hudson River Valley had already been accomplished. The next operation required moving south along the Hudson to take Albany. However, the terrain was treacherous, and moving material, roads were mere trails, haphazardly hacked through dense forest and invaded by thick undergrowth and fallen trees and limbs. Often hampering advance were around 40 deep ravines, which could only be crossed after bridges were built, plus occasional bogs and swamps and marshes. You're moving 7,000 plus men into a wilderness, heavily wooded with all of these ravines, as well as the other things that go on in that neck of the woods. These delays bought time for General Philip Schuyler, commander of the Northern Department of the colonies, to add to Burgoyne's traveling woes. Schuyler sent out 1,000 axemen to fell trees across the route. Some of these men rolled boulders down hills into creeks to make them impassable. Others destroyed bridges and several dug ditches. Grain fields were burned so that livestock could not have feed. It took Burgoyne 21 days to traverse 23 miles. The delays caused by these actions enabled Schuyler to build up his army. General Arthur St. Clair's main force, Colonel Pierce Long's detachment from Skanesboro, and Brigadier General John Nixon's 600 Continentals strengthened Schuyler's forces to 4,500, of which 2,900 were Continentals and 1,600 were militia. Dissatisfied with his position at Fort Edward, that's to the north of the battle area, Schuyler retreated and established his camp at Stillwater, some 12 miles south. Stillwater is, let's say, right along in here. Oh, no, this is Saratoga up here. Stillwater will be somewhere along in here. Fort George, a little further north, and in the middle you have the Saratoga area. Now, in the meantime, Burgoyne expected to meet up with Major General William Howe's main army. He's the British general, as he advanced up from New York. So William Howe is the first guy that Burgoyne expects to meet him in Albany. This is the strategy for them to meet there, take that city and pretty much decimate the major colonial encampment at that particular area. Complications, though, set in when he received word that Howe had changed his plans by deciding to deploy against General Washington's Continental Army at Philadelphia. So he's got no help now coming up from the south unless other plans are made. And so Burgoyne, whose disposition was habitually inflexible, decided to press on with his original plan to take Albany all by himself and then keep moving all the way to New York. This is going to be a tough row to hoe for him, as we will determine. On September 13th, Burgoyne and his 6,000 British troops crossed the Hudson River and encamped at Saratoga. Now, his first in a series of setbacks occurred when he learned that most of his Indian scouts had deserted, leaving him without intelligence on the location and intentions of enemy forces. You can't conduct a campaign if you don't know what the enemy's up to. Now, he was depending on Indian scouts, volunteers. Now, I don't have to go into great bit of detail that these people had no order in their souls and certainly were not going to submit to military discipline. And so when they got in their minds that they didn't any longer want to do any scouting for Burgoyne, they just left and left him without intelligence. So on September 18th, Burgoyne arrived near the American encampment at Bemis Heights with Freeman's Farm situated between the two forces. And sans intelligence, he had no idea his army was outnumbered. The American situation was strengthened in the summer of 1777 when Washington deployed forces commanded by Major General Benjamin Lincoln and Colonel Daniel Morgan to assist Major General Philip Schuyler at Stillwater. This is located a few miles south of Saratoga. And due to political infighting, the frictions among Schuyler and other officers, Washington appointed Major General Horatio Gates as commander of the Northern Department, replacing Schuyler. There's a picture of Gates right there. He's not a pretty man. But he was even a worse general. He was in the Continental Army, and he forced British Major General John Burgoyne to surrender on October the 17th of 77, following the defeat at Bemis Heights near Saratoga. We'll get into a bit of detail about the two battles, but we will learn before we're done that he could have bought a ticket. He never was involved in either of the battles. He sat at base camp and received information from his reconnaissance corps. But he never rode a horse. He never got up out of his chair. He just waited until people returned with the information. He delivered orders, and that was it. Orders that on many occasions were ignored. Now, prior to Burgoyne's advance to Saratoga, Gates organized his army to take a strategic position at Bemis Heights. The stage was set for the campaign that, in retrospective analysis, would determine the outcome of the War for Independence. Leading up to this point, three critical events occurred that would have great impact on the coming conflict. First of all, the arrival of Major General Benedict Arnold on 24 July. Secondly, the deployment of Arnold with 950 volunteers to relieve Fort Stanwix, which he accomplished without firing a shot by use of a half-wit to propagandize British General St. Ledger into thinking Arnold was advancing with thousands of troops and inspired him to retreat back to Canada. This man who went in there was a bit of a half-wit, but he was quite the talker, and went in there saying that he had learned these things, and St. Ledger bought it and evacuated without cause. Thirdly, the murder and scalping of Miss Jane McCrae. Now we're going to get into incidences that have to do with how Jesus Christ controls history. This is a painting, a depiction of the death of Jane McCrae. It's by John Vanderlyn, done in 1804. So let's learn about this young woman. The scalp of Miss Jane McCrae. Jane McCrae was the daughter of the Reverend John McCrae of New Jersey, who, following her father's death, lived with her brother John near Saratoga, New York. When war broke out between the colonies and Great Britain, Jane's brothers sided with the American forces, while Jane's fiancé, David Jones, became a loyalist, a colonial who remained loyal to the British government. As the wedding day approached, Jane made preparations to leave Saratoga and travel to Ticonderoga, where David was serving with the loyalist militia under the command of Burgoyne. En route to Ticonderoga, Jane and her party stopped at Fort Edward for the night, where she stayed at the home of Sarah McNeil. The next day, before leaving Fort Ticonderoga, the McNeil house fell upon assault by an Indian raiding party who captured the two women. The truth of what followed is still a mystery. Some accounts claim that the Indians were actually sent by Burgoyne to escort Miss McRae to Ticonderoga. Before leaving Fort Edward with McRae, the Indians got into an argument, at which point one of them suddenly took a tomahawk and scalped Jane McRae. Another account asserts that Americans pursuing the Indians after the alleged raid accidentally shot McRae in a firefight. You can find both stories. What actually happened was not as important as what was perceived as having happened. The latter played a great part in the colonials' victory in the Saratoga campaign and served as motivation for those wary of challenging the crown to join with the patriots in pursuit of independence. A summary of how the death of Jane McRae was a key incident in the war for independence is important to note before we engage the battles at Saratoga. Tales of the gruesome activities of some of Burgoyne's Indian allies led more and more American volunteers to join Gates's army. The most famous of the Indian atrocities was the murder of young Jane McRae, the fiancée of a loyalist officer in Burgoyne's army. Apparently, several of Burgoyne's Indian scouts argued over who would have the honor of escorting the woman into camp, and in the heat of the argument, one of the Indians shot and scalped her and then carried his grisly trophy into camp, whereas the story goes, it was recognized by her distraught lover. Though it was one incident among many in the history of frontier violence, this tale in particular touched the popular imagination. Gates referred to it as a letter of protest to Burgoyne, a letter which was reprinted throughout New England. The result was a spectacular increase in the number of American volunteers. With these new recruits and the return of Arnold's men from Fort Stanwix, Gates soon commanded an army of 7,000, while Burgoyne's forces, after losses at the Battle of Bennington, shrunk to fewer than 6,000. In mid-August, Burgoyne got more bad news. He learned that Howe's army at New York had sailed for the Delaware Bay on July the 23rd, and Burgoyne was now on his own. A second account of the impact of the scalping of Jane McRae amplifies the impact that the news of the incident led to a significant increase in volunteers to assist Gates at Saratoga. The murder and scalping of Jane McRae on July the 22nd, had fed fuel to the fires of rebel passion that were flaming throughout the countryside. That one event did more to arouse the patriots and raise volunteers for Gates's army than all the depredations of Tories and Indians in New York could possibly have caused. Volunteers were on the march in the form of newly raised militia, who continued to swarm into the camps of Bemis Heights and those of General Lincoln in Vermont. They came in their civilian clothes, each with a family musket or fowling piece, some in odd groups, some in companies, but all armed, and many with their own ammunition. By the end of September, Lincoln had joined Gates at Bemis Heights, bringing his militia strength up to 4,300. At the end of the first week of October, Gates' strength reached 11,000, of which 2,700 were Continentals and the rest militia. An account of the impact of Jane's death and her burial at Fort Edward, New York, is the subject of this article from Ancestry.com. This is a website that tracks who you're related to. You can go on that site and type in Fred Jones, who was a long-lost great-great-great-uncle, and it'll pop up, and you can figure out how he is related. So on this site, you can type in information about Jane McRae and learn the following. In 1777, Jane McCrae was 26 years old and living at the farm of her older brother, Colonel John McCrae, at Fort Edward, New York, to be close to her fiancé, Lieutenant David Jones, a loyalist serving with General Burgoyne's army. On July 27th of that year, while she was visiting the home of Mrs. McNeil, the two women were captured by Indians allied to the British. Since both women were under the protection of General Burgoyne, they were reasonably sure nothing would happen to them. Their captors separated into two bands, each with one of the women. When Ms. McNeil, a cousin of General Simon Fraser's, arrived with her captors at the British camp, she wondered where Jane was, since she had departed ahead of Mrs. McNeil. And shortly thereafter, the first party of Indians returned to the camp with a fresh scalp lock. It seems an argument had ensued over Jane McCrae, and to settle the argument, she had been killed. General Burgoyne could not punish the guilty party for fear of breaking his alliance with them. This engaged the countryside, and Jane became an instant martyr to the revolutionary cause. Men took up arms to revenge this wrongdoing and were formed into many companies, some from as far away as the Green Mountains of Vermont. And this greatly aided the rebel cause and helped several months later in the defeat of Burgoyne's British Army at Saratoga, a major turning point in the Revolutionary War. Jane was first buried a few miles north of Fort Edward and later buried at Union Cemetery in Fort Edward. But this was not the end of her tale. Nearly 50 years later, when he wrote the book, The Last of the Mohegans, James Fenimore Cooper immortalized Jane's story when he created the character of Cora. Now it's time for the Saratoga campaign, the Battle of Freeman's Farm. The reinforcement that arrived for Horatio Gates put the Americans at a numerical advantage over John Burgoyne's army that had suffered losses by means of casualties as well as defections. By September 9, Gates' forces exceeded 7,000 with the addition of Colonel Morgan's corps of Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland riflemen. Gates added to these by putting under Morgan's command Major Henry Dearborn's 250 hand-picked infantrymen armed with muskets and bayonets. Gates also realized the strength of his army's personnel. They were primarily militiamen who were better suited to fighting in rough terrain and excelled in forest warfare. On September 12th, he established his headquarters at Bemis Heights, an area situated for efficient defense. The Heights was a plateau rising some 200 to 300 feet above the Hudson, which flowed southward to his right. The wooded shores along the river would slow any subsequent movement of the Loyalists toward Albany. Well, let's take a look at some maps here. This is Bemis Heights, this brown area here. That's the base of operations, the headquarters for General Gates. You can notice these little drawings here indicate wooded areas. You're going to have right here is where Burgoyne established his camp at Swords Farm, and it's about 4 miles this way to Bemis Heights. And in this piece of real estate in between, there are ravines, as we'll note later, there are gullies, there are branches and creeks, and there's a lot of trees. And so when he moves this operation southward to this area, to Freeman's Farm right here, it is impossible for them to see Bemis Heights. And so they need to have reconnaissance to let them know exactly what the colonists are up to. And this was hard to do because they'd lost all of their Indian scouts. And when you move through the trees here, this is where the militiamen were at their best. And so any of the scouts that came through those trees were picked off. So in essence, at Bemis Heights, Gates was operating in secrecy, and therefore Burgoyne had little reconnaissance information to go on. This is the Hudson River, quite obviously, here. So that, in other words, guards the right flank of Bemis Heights. This is about 300 feet above, and he's got deployments that we'll note as we go along. But these deployments, of course, going to be the point of attack here. This is Learned here. You have Arnold and Morgan with his riflemen over on the left flank. And on the right, in this area right here, Gates commanded that area as well. So we'll see as we go through some of these things as they develop. The forest was broken only by the fields cleared for agriculture by Sword, Freeman, McBride, Coulter, and Nielsen Farms. I think there is a map here somewhere that might show some of these farms. I'll have to drill down in here. It may be in the second group that we have that shows the farms. Up here you have Sword's farm. Right in here is Freeman's farm. This is Nielsen's farm. You have other farms that are located approximately here and here. This is McBride's up here, and this is Coulter. So these five farms, and these white areas you see are where they have cleared the land of the forest and therefore have planted crops or grazing livestock. So that's the situation that gives you the lay of the land for the battles that are coming up. The open areas were broken by ravines and streams, however. And the largest of each was the ravine to the north of Freeman's farm. There's a big ravine. This is Freeman's farm here, and there's a big ravine up in here that's difficult to cross. So they have to come down and across in order to get to the positions that they desire. These open areas, therefore, were large. Each was a ravine to the north of Freeman's farm. There was Mill Creek that flowed between Gates' headquarters and Freeman's farm. So we have Gates' headquarters here, and there is this Mill Creek here. And that's a barrier that was useful as far as the battles were concerned. Now, the American encampment was fortified with a system of field works. There were trenches and breastworks of logs and earth, put plus three artillery redoubts. Now, we need to go back and take a look at redoubts. I think we drill back to this right here. These are redoubts here, these little jagged lines. And in them, there are defensible areas where it's impossible for a small group of people to penetrate. These are the areas in which these redoubts are built. And we'll see redoubts come into the future of our study, and we'll take a little bit of time to define that. The only area of concern was the high ground to the west of Bemis Heights. I want to show that. That's this area right here. At first, this high ground was not defended by the Continentals and the militia, and therefore that was something that had been learned by Burgoyne, who's stationed up here, and therefore this was a target for them to try and take that high ground and dump artillery down on headquarters and then rush the area and drive them into the Hudson. We'll see the attempt to do that on two occasions, but both failed. Now, General Burgoyne and General Simon Fraser's strategy then was to take that hill and rain artillery down on Gates' headquarters. Now, by September 17th, Burgoyne has moved into the area and established his headquarters at Swords Farm. He was not apprised of Gates' disposition, although he was only 4 miles north of Bemis Heights. The loss of all but 50 of his Indian scouts had resulted in an almost total loss of dependable reconnaissance. Now, on the morning of September 19th, General Gates' forces were deployed with a center commanded by Brigadier General Ebenezer Learned. And that's back one. This is Learned here. That's the center of his arrangement, his strategy. The right wing was composed of artillery under Brigadier Generals Glover and Patterson, but remained under Gates' command. That's over here on the right. The left wing was under the command of Major General Benedict Arnold, and it included Colonel Morgan's Corps of Light Infantry, and that's over here. Now, with his troops deployed and excellent reconnaissance, Gates allowed Burgoyne to make the first move. The British general had also decided on a three-pronged offensive. His left wing was commanded by Baron Friedrich von Riedesel. How about that, Burnell? Well, I got that from none other than Craig Fanning. I wondered, he's got to know that, and I took it to him, and he said, yes, it's Friedrich von Riedesel, and consisted of three infantry regiments and artillery. Their task was to attack the Americans' right flank. So the right flank is over here, so this group over here under Riedesel has got that bunch. The British center was commanded by Brigadier General James Hamilton. It had 1,100 men made up of battalion companies of the 9th, 20th, 21st, and 62nd British regiments, plus artillery. And Burgoyne accompanied this group. That's right in the middle right here. Burgoyne's right wing was commanded by General Simon Fraser, whose mission was to envelop the American left, seize the high ground to the west of Bemis Heights, and unleash artillery on the American encampment. If successful, he would then charge the position and drive the Patriots into the Hudson. And so this is Fraser right here. This is his target down here, this high ground that you can't see on this map. It's located right here. He wants to move through this area and take the high ground. That's his objective. Now, Fraser had at his disposal a brigade of artillery, the light infantry of 10 British companies and their regiments, plus these 10 grenadier companies. In addition, Fraser had the battalion companies of the British 24th and Lieutenant Colonel Heinrich von Bremen's Brunswick Riflemen. His wing also included 50 Indians, 150 Tories, 80 Canadians, and 50 British marksmen. So they're loaded up on the British right. And by 10 o'clock, Riedesel's columns had advanced to a point almost due east of Freeman's Farm. And you can see that right here. Freeman's Farm is located right here, and Riedesel is moved into this spot here. Hamilton had assumed his position directly in front of Freeman's Farm, and Burgoyne's deployments were all in place by 12:30. All these movements were reported to Gates by his scouts. Gates had assumed a position that he knew complemented the fighting skills of his troops, dominated by militia, citizen soldiers whose expertise with weaponry was superior, but who did not have the training of regular soldiers. Freeman's Farm consisted of gently rolling open fields surrounded by forests. Bemis Heights, 1 mile to the south, is a natural plateau east of the Hudson River and south of Mill Creek. Militarily, this was key terrain that served as a gateway south to Albany, New York. The dense forest surrounding Bemis Heights provided the combatants with stealthy maneuver room as well as cover and concealment. At Bemis Heights, high ground extended north, west, and east, while the south remained flat and open. In the northwestern corner of Bemis Heights was Nielsen's Farm, a piece of land owned by a Patriot supporter. The fields of fire inherent in the open farmlands were excellent for both small arms and artillery. So now the stage is set. Both armies had achieved their desired positions on the field, and all that was left was for someone to pull the first round. We'll start the battle at 20 till the hour.